House Committee on Energy and Environment will come to order. We have a busy day today. I'm going to announce at the beginning that we are going to carry over House Bill 2048 on paint stewardship until our next meeting. We are also going to carry over the public hearing on House Bill 2807 to the next meeting. And House Bill 2801, we're waiting on the fiscal colleagues. It's possible it'll be here by the end of the committee meeting, so we will hold on and hope that that comes in by the end of the committee meeting. And with that, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2004. And you'll remember, colleagues, this is the bill. Well, Adam, go ahead.
Chair Barry, members of the committee, House Bill 2004 increases the amount of money collected from residential electric customers for low-income electric bill assistance dependent on Oregon Housing and Community Services Department findings. It feels the sunset on the collection of additional monies for low-income electric assistance. Committee, the dash two amendments were adopted Thursday, April 4th. The committee is being asked to consider the dash three amendments presently. The dash three amendments replace the measure. They increase the amount of money collected from residential electric customers for low-income electric.
Let me interrupt you for a second. Say the functional difference between the dash threes and the dash twos is a date change. There was a typographical error in the dash twos amendments that referred to dates in the past as opposed to dates in the future, and unfortunately, we just caught that. So we're going to need to rescind the dash twos and move the dash threes, which are otherwise functionally the same.
Yes.
Good. Okay. Representative Boone?
Mr. Chair, I move to substitute the dash three amendments dated April 9th, 2013 for the dash two amendments dated April 4th, 2013.
Vice Chair Boone moves to substitute the dash three amendments dated April 9th, 2013 for the dash two amendments dated April 4th, 2013. Is there any discussion? Any objection?
I have a question. Yeah. So this essentially removes a 24-month limit on additional fee collection. Is that correct?
Representative, the that dash twos accomplish that as well. The dash threes are just the date change of the dash twos. Okay. Is there objection on the amendment? Seeing none, motion carries. Vice Chair Boone?
Mr. Chair, I move... House Bill 2004 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Boone moves House Bill 2004 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Benz?
Aye.
Representative Dimbrough?
Aye.
Representative Reardon?
Aye.
Representative Vega Peterson?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Excused.
Representative Whitsitt?
No.
Vice Chair Johnson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Chair Bailey?
Aye. Motion carries. And volunteers to carry? And I'll jump up over once.
Is that two minutes?
Oh, yeah. Well, tell you what. Why don't we assign Representatives McLean and Kotek to carry? That'll be fun.
They already have the picture.
And I'm sure I'll hear if that doesn't work out. And we can substitute somebody else. All right, so with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2004 and open a work session on House Bill 2893. Colleagues, we amended this bill in the last session. I believe it is ready to go. Thanks again to Representative Reardon for his great work on building consensus amongst the work group on solar. I think we got a really good product here. And Vice Chair Boone, do you have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2893 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and request that the subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded.
Vice Chair Boone moves House Bill 2893 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and request that the subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded. Discussion. Colleagues, you'll note that the original referral to Ways and Means was on the base bill. This has been a gut and stuff of the base bill, and it's no longer applicable. Okay. Clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Benz?
Aye.
Representative Dimbrough?
Aye.
Representative Reardon?
Aye.
Representative Vega Peterson?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Excused.
Representative Whitsitt?
No.
Vice Chair Johnson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Chair Bailey?
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Reardon, would you like to carry?
I'd be delighted.
Thank you very much, Representative. Close the work session on House Bill 2893. open a work session on House Bill 2981. Adam?
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, House Bill 2981 allows the exemption from ad valorem property taxation under the Rural Renewable Energy Development, or RED, program if either governing body or zone sponsor adopts a resolution waiving the requirements, or if a $5 million investment is made, takes effect 91 days after signing die. The committee is being asked to consider the Dash 1 amendments. The Dash 1 amendments replace the measure. They allow exemption from ad valorem property taxation under the RED program if the governing body of the zone sponsor adopts a resolution waiving the requirements, and if a $5 million investment is made, it takes effect 91 days after signing die. There is a revenue impact statement, and it currently has a subsequent referral to the House Committee on Revenue.
I believe this bill is ready to go on to revenue for further examination. Representative Boone?
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated March 8, 2013.
Vice Chair Boone moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated March 8, 2013. Is there discussion? Is there objection to the Dash 1s? Seeing none, they're adopted. Vice Chair Boone?
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2981, as amended, be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the House Committee on Revenue by prior reference.
Vice Chair Boone moves House Bill 2981 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the House Committee on Revenue by prior reference. Discussion. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Only to say, since you and I both sit on revenue, I'm looking forward to having a discussion at a slightly different angle on this bill. And I'll very probably be a yes there, as I'm going to be here.
Thank you. I'm seeing head nods from Representative Vega Peterson as well. Okay. Seeing no further discussion, please call the roll.
Representative Benz?
Aye.
Representative Dembrose?
Aye.
Representative Bruden?
Aye.
Representative Baker Peterson?
Aye.
Representative Wiseman?
Excused.
Representative Whitsitt?
Aye.
Vice Chair Johnson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Chair Bailey?
Aye. Motion carries. It's on its way to revenue. Close the work session on House Bill 2981. Open a work session on House Bill 3251. Adam?
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, House Bill 3251, the committee is being asked to consider the Dash 1 amendments. The Dash 1 amendments replace the measure. They prohibit operation of motor vehicles weighing more than 200 pounds and Class 1, 2, 3, and 4 vehicles in beds and banks of any waterway in the Common School Forest Lands or Elliott State Forest Lands. This excludes boats, licensed hunters engaged in hunting activities, vehicles owned by the state or local government, or those owned by persons contracted by local, state, or federal governments, vehicles engaged in emergency rescue, vehicles crossing from a road surface on one side of the bank to a road surface on the other side of the bank, or vehicles engaged in activities specified by rule by the Department of State Lands. Makes a Class A violation with a maximum fine of $2,000. There is no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, and there is no subsequent referral.
Great. And here to explain the Dash 1s.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Michael Verde from the State Treasurer's Office. As Mr. Crawford was saying, the Dash 1 amendments, the main change in the Dash 1 amendments is simply exempt hunters who are licensed to be hunting. It also makes a few other changes, which I mentioned in the first public hearing, regarding adding the exception for recovery activities and vehicles that are performing work under contract with government.
Thank you. Representative Reed?
I just want to comment that I noticed that the weight had also been increased, or was that, and it went to from 200 pounds to 1,000.
Mr. Chair, Representative Reed, that was in a different amendment.
It was. Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Boone?
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated March 29th, 2013.
Vice Chair Boone moves the Dash 1 amendments dated March 29th, 2013. Is there discussion on the amendments? Is there objection to the amendments? Motion carries. Vice Chair Boone?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3251 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Boone moves House Bill 3451 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Representative
Benz. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be a no on this, and I just want to say that it occurs to me that this is a bill looking for a reason to exist. The exceptions wipe out most of the reason for the bill, so I'll be a no.
Thank you. Further discussion? Seeing none, clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Finch?
No.
Representative Dimbro?
Yes.
Representative Gruden?
Yes.
Representative Vega Peterson?
Yes.
Representative Widener?
Excused.
Representative Woodsett?
No.
Vice Chair Johnson?
No.
Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Chair Bailey?
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Dimbro, would you be willing to carry?
Certainly.
Thank you. And close the work session on House Bill 3251. Open a work session on House Bill 3337. Adam?
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, House Bill 3337 adds the conservation and maintenance of ecosystems as a goal to the state policy relating to ecosystems and land use. It directs the governor's office with the assistance of the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board to review local, state, and federal conservation plans, propose process for the alignment of those plans, develop statewide goals for maintenance, enhancement, and restoration of ecosystem services, and make all information available to the public. It encourages the state agencies and local governments to adopt programs to conserve or enhance ecosystem services, allows state agencies and local governments to use payments for eco-services if compensatory mitigation is used, provides guidelines to compensatory mitigation, requires state agencies and local governments to compare to the extent practicable costs related to natural infrastructure as a part of or in lieu of development projects and infrastructure. It allows the state agency to purchase measurable ecological outcomes, declares an emergency, and is effective on passage. The committee is being asked to consider the -1 amendments. The -1 amendments modify the measure to allow for greater latitude for state agencies and local governments when designing compensatory mitigation programs, encourages rather than requires state agencies and local governments to compare to the extent practical costs related to natural infrastructure as part or in lieu of development projects and infrastructure state agencies. There is a fiscal impact statement, and it does have a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee of Ways and Means.
Colleagues, this bill will have additional discussion in the Ways and Means Committee. I have a letter here from the governor's office that I received literally as I was walking into committee, so I apologize, I don't have more copies of it, saying that they are committed to continuing the conversation in Ways and Means. And I think it's ready to head down there. So, Representative Boone?
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the -1 amendments dated March 15th, 2013.
Vice Chair Boone moves to adopt the -1 amendments dated March 15th, 2013. Is there any discussion? Any objections to the amendments? Hearing none, motion carries. Vice Chair Boone?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3337 as amended to the floor with a due-pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Vice Chair Boone moves House Bill 3337 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Their discussion. Vice Chair Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I strongly disagree with moving this to Ways and Means. It's not a policy committee. It's a large topic. There are a lot of undefined components of this bill, so I'll be a no.
Thank you. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to say this is a most interesting concept and a most interesting bill. And I've spent a great deal of time thinking about this issue, and we had, of course, an opportunity to talk about it earlier. My concern is that we can't have a complete conversation about a bill like this unless we have in front of us all of the other mitigation activities and mitigation requirements and agencies that are already engaged in mitigation and offsetting that which we do, summarized and understood. And this is consistent with our conversation last time about needing a baseline against which we can measure the need for the many things that are suggested by this bill. I fear that if we send this bill out in anything close to this form without a great deal more work, what we encourage is a great deal of head-scratching by the agencies that are then given this list of suggestions, followed up by a must at the end. And I have no idea what the cost of that exercise might be, but worse, I don't think we're giving them any guidance or any direction in how they're supposed to carry out that which this bill suggests should happen. And so I'm thinking that in many of our mitigation circumstances, we haven't done that work, and it's so important, because when one is going to mitigate, you've got to have an end to it. There's got to be some framework within which it's done. And if we don't have that framework, we invite an awful lot of spending as people try to accomplish something they haven't been given appropriate instructions to do. So I'll be no.
Thank you. Seeing no. Representative Dembrough.
Mr. Chair, I have a question. You know, once, just to follow up on the line of questioning, once this goes down to Ways and Means, do you see yourself and perhaps the vice chairs having a role to play in helping them work this bill?
Representative Dembrough, I cannot speak for the co-chairs of a subcommittee and to what their intent will be. It is my hope that to stay engaged in the process.
That would be my hope, too, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Reardon.
What information, I'm sorry, I'm new here, first time through. What information does Ways and Means have that we don't have to address this situation?
Representative Reardon, I believe the Committee on Ways and Means has the budgetary information that will be necessary for the operation of state agencies to be able to address some of the questions about how they would handle and manage such a program. Seeing no further discussion, clerk will please call the roll.
Representative Benz?
No.
Representative Dembrough?
Yes.
Representative Reardon?
No.
Representative Dave Peterson?
Yes.
Representative Widener? Representative Whitsitt?
No.
Chair Johnson?
No.
Chair Booth, Vice Chair Booth?
Aye.
Chair Bailey?
Aye. The committee will stand at ease. Committee will come to order. Colleagues, we are in the process of the vote on House Bill 3337. Representative Reardon, how do you vote?
Aye.
Representative Reardon votes aye. Motion carries. House Bill 3337 is on its way to the House Committee on Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Close the work session on House Bill 3337. Thank you, colleagues. And we are going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3030. Adam?
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, House Bill 3030 requires the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality, or DEQ, to set up a grant and loan program for environmental studies and cleanup plans, establishes the Industrial Sites Cleanup Fund, appropriates money from the general fund to start grant and loan program. The committee is being asked to consider the Dash 2 amendments. The Dash 2 amendments replace the measure. They add demolition of structures containing hazardous substances to the definition of environmental action, adds a provision of financial assistance for environmental actions to purposes of Brownfields Redevelopment Fund, appropriates $10 million to the Brownfields Redevelopment Fund, allows the Department of Revenue to set by rule a schedule for declining percentage adjustment of real property found to contain hazardous substance release, requires the rule to not allow any adjustment after 10 years, allows the value of real property to be determined under the Oregon Revised Statute on an assessment of real property for taxation and Department of Revenue rule if property owners begin removal or mediation action to cure hazardous substance release. In the assessment year, the hazardous material is discovered, and every year following the discovery of the hazardous material release, provides requirements for verification system for removal or remediation actions, takes effect 91 days after sine die.
Representative Frederick, so glad to have you join us in front of the committee.
Chair Bailey, thank you for inviting me. Members of the committee, good to see you as well. I'm Representative Lou Frederick. I represent House District 43, North and Northeast Portland. We're here to talk about House Bill 3030, the Dash 2 amendments, which you have, as you just mentioned. This bill is about brownfields, those small contaminated sites that are present in everybody's neighborhood. 2 years ago, we did a study, and I found 143 in my district. I think, Representative Bentz, I think we found about 140 or so in your district as well. Most of them got that way, decades ago. Many have been recognized as contaminated for many years. These are the old gas stations and mechanic shops, the photo finishing businesses and the dry cleaners, the farm chemical storage facility. All parts of the state have them, urban, rural, suburban. When I was growing up, there were gas stations usually with repair facilities attached everywhere. When I was growing up, there was also a lot less attention paid to how these substances should be handled, stored, or even discarded. Even as knowledge caught up, practices lagged behind. I witnessed a shop practices when I took it to one of the mechanic shops that I went to that left deep and lasting contamination of soil in my own neighborhood, and that was just about 25 years ago. So the problem is that because we know that these sites present a hazard for some uses, and because cleaning them enough to make them safe can be expensive, many of them simply sit vacant. Some of them are in neighborhoods accessible to kids. Some of them are gated and abandoned. In any case, they represent classic cases of blight. But they also represent opportunities. When they are restored to a non-toxic state, they can be productive again for residences, agriculture, recreation, or commerce. They are often in excellent locations. That's why they were chosen decades ago for the uses that contaminated them. They tend to be accessible, served by utilities, and zoned for appropriate productive uses for the neighborhoods that they now drag down. Several others will testify about the particulars and the technical details of this bill. We are seeking to accomplish two things here. Recapitalize the Brownfields Redevelopment Fund, which is currently largely depleted, and reorient determinations of real market value of these sites for purposes of tax assessments to phase out tax incentives for neglecting these properties. I understand the second part of that bill is still undergoing some fine-tuning. Now, I want to point out an important fact about these bills. Most of those testifying today are from governmental agencies, but most of these small contaminated properties are in private ownership and will, when returned to productive use, will remain in private ownership. There is good public good in that, but this bill is about lowering barriers to private productive use of this reservoir of available land in prime locations, as well as making our neighborhood safer. Questions? Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Representative Frederick. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I always like to listen to Representative Frederick talk. He has such a great speaking voice. Mine's not so great. But I just wanted to add a little bit of juice to this because we did have a case like this. And it wasn't a gas station. It was a mill, an old mill in Astoria. And they have now a beautiful housing development, and they have a pond, and it's called the Mill Pond. And it's right on the Riverwalk, and they're kind of coveted places to live. It's in Uppertown, and they're nice places, and it's a case of successful brownfields conversion or whatever you call it.
It's also getting.
I had my doubts at first about it, you know, thinking, can you really clean this up? And they did, and they did. They can, and they did.
Chair Bailey, Representative Boone, that particular site is getting statewide and national attention because of how well it's been cleaned up. I hope that the same kind of thing takes place about three blocks from my house, where there's one place that's been empty for about 25, 30 years. I saw them contaminate the backyard, the back part of the house, when a fellow, the mechanic who I'd taken my car to, came out with a bucket full of a solvent and just poured it into the ground. And I said, you can't do that. And he said, I've been doing it for years. I said, well, you weren't supposed to be doing that then. It remains empty. It remains empty with graffiti on it on a regular basis, wooden structure. And all around it is new buildings and condos and houses. And it sits there as a blight on the... And it's there because it costs a lot to get it cleaned up. They don't know what's there, and it's been the tax situation has been basically allowing it to stay empty. So we're trying to get something cleaned up there.
Additional questions? Representative, I want to thank you for your ongoing work on this. I know you've spent years working on this, and it's a critical issue both for economic development as well as environmental health, obviously. And from what I understand, what you're working towards here is a bill that would change the incentive system essentially to both give people an incentive to clean up brownfields as well as to provide the funding and the fund to be able to do so. And appreciate your work on this.
Exactly that. Thank you very much, Representative.
Thank you. Paul Grove, Palmer Mason, and John Phillip, please. The agency troika. All right. Mr. Grove, would you like to begin?
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paul Grove with the Oregon Business Development Department, Business Oregon. Appreciate the opportunity today to provide just a little bit of background information on the Brownfields Redevelopment Fund program that resides in our department and that is the subject of the -2 amendments. For those that aren't familiar, and I'll apologize for just providing a very brief high-level overview of brownfields in general, but they are those properties that where expansion or redevelopment is complicated by real or perceived contamination. And so the purpose of this program, at the end of the day, is to assist municipalities and private landowners with the financing to evaluate, clean up, and redevelop these properties for future economic development activities. We work with, again, municipalities and private landowners to make this happen. It's important to note who isn't eligible under the program as well, and those applicants that are in violation of an existing enforcement order would not receive assistance through this program, nor would Superfund sites. There are two ways in which we, and I'd be remiss in not noting this earlier, in any project that we evaluate and ultimately fund through this program, we work in close collaboration and consultation with DEQ. And we work hand in glove at the very beginning of the process and continue that throughout the process. So I want to note that up front. The Redevelopment Fund provides grants and loans. The grants are very small scale for the most part and are used for assessment-related activities. The loans vary based on the project size, the degree of contamination or issues that the property face, and they vary from a small-scale loan from $20,000 to, depending on the project, and this is an outlier, I want to note that, upwards of $3 million. But again, everything is project-specific. The fund is very flexible, noting the different needs that the properties face, depending on, again, on the level of contamination that may exist. And lastly, I'll note four items that the program ultimately supports. Talk about determinations or assessments. Also talk about, it also supports feasibility studies regarding the potential cleanup, plan for remedial actions, and then ultimately the remedial or removal action for those properties. A couple of minor, or not minor, but really quick facts at the end of the day. A lot of folks equate brownfield and brownfield redevelopment with the Portland metro area. Of the projects that we've financed, I believe approximately 25% have been in the metro area. And as Representative Boone noted, a project that was successfully completed in Astoria, and we're actually evaluating one in Baker City as we speak today. So there's statewide applicability to this fund and this program, and it has been a successful tool in our efforts to help make these properties available for future economic development activities. So that's a high-level overview of the program and how it works. And welcome any questions you may have.
Thank you. Mr. Mason.
I have a question.
Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Whitsitt.
I just had a question. You mentioned real or perceived contamination. Could you describe how you would mitigate a perceived contamination?
Chair Bailey, Representative, and that's a good question. I think depending on one of the first things we would do, depending on the need and the project proponents' discussions that we have with DEQ, would be to identify whether or not there is any contamination there. And it may be that there is no contamination at the end of the day. So then we could move forward accordingly, and the landowner could move forward accordingly.
Thank you. Mr. Mason.
Yeah. Chair Bailey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Palmer Mason. I'm the government relations manager for DEQ. I'm asking the committee staff to pass out a map, which I'll explain here momentarily. But before I do, DEQ is here to support this bill, House Bill 3030, because it represents a case of a win-win situation. The more we can do to clean up brownfield sites or contaminated properties, the more we can improve Oregon's environment as well as put properties back in productive use. So we're very supportive of any legislative effort to increase the dollars that are available to help get that win-win, the environmental win as well as the economic development win. So we're very encouraged to see the effort to recapitalize the fund. And I would note that one of the impediments to improving property and putting it back into productive use is the potential risk that a developer or local government might face if they were to acquire or look to develop the property. And so where this state can assist Business Oregon or DEQ for that matter and help the private sector understand the potential contamination on a site and get a definitive answer about that risk, the more certainty developers or local governments have about moving forward on pieces of property. So again, any effort to do that I think is both an environmental win as well as an economic development win. The map that I'm sharing with you speaks to the point that Paul raised about brownfields and contaminated properties being actually a statewide issue. What you have here is sites that are in our environmental cleanup database. It's roughly 4,800 sites. These are not all sites where there is actual contamination. It's either known or suspected contamination at these sites. So I didn't want to suggest to you that each individual star is an actual contaminated property, but we either know of contamination based on an actual release or there's a suspected reason for there to be a release. About a third of these sites listed here have actually gotten what we call a no further action letter, meaning that they've reached a standard of safety, both either from a public health or environmental standard point of view, and a site is quote-unquote clean. And I do want to say to the committee, when DEQ looks at contaminated properties, we take a risk-based approach. So we look at the property based on the current land use and the future anticipated land use to set the standard for public health or environmental cleanup. And what I mean by that is if we're talking about residential properties, we're going to apply a higher standard for cleanliness than we would for commercial or industrial properties. That's what the risk-based approach references. So in any event, about a third of these sites have actually been cleaned up, which, as you can see, still leaves quite a few out there for work. And as I said, it represents a situation where it's an opportunity to do some good for the environment, and it's an opportunity to turn something into productive use again. So that's what I wanted to share with you on that map. And I would add, we typically get about an additional 50 to 100 sites in our database each year. So this list continues to be a rather sizable list, and we have about 400 active sites, which are also represented here. But I can stop and just take any questions from the committee.
Great. Thank you. Mr. Phillips.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Phillips of the Oregon Department of Revenue. We are neutral on this bill, and we don't have really any comments about the policy. We're just here to talk about the mechanics of the dash 1, section 5 and 6. In the dash 1, section 5 and 6, it talks about how the county assessors will impose a declining adjustment percentage to the market value of properties. You know how property value works. If your property value goes up because the market perceives it as valuable, then you potentially would pay more taxes depending on the formula. If it's contaminated and it's someone would not pay the full price because they have to consider the fact that there's a cost to cure, they would pay less. So in some ways, the property tax system works as a disincentive to improvements because people are paying less. They also experience, though, however, a lack of ability to move the property to someone else or develop it in some cases. But what I'm really here to talk about is how that adjustment factor in the dash one works. It creates a declining percentage adjustment by which the assessors would then adjust the market value in the property to something other than market value on the property. And I think the idea is there is that as long as you're remediating the property, the value would go down. If you were not remediating the property, the value would go up. And that's the adjustment that would be applied. The issue, the concern I guess we have is that the Constitution defines what real market value is. And so when we look to the definition of real market value in the Constitution, it doesn't really allow us to imagine a world short of a constitutional change that would allow us to change what the market value is. So if the assessors are adjusting market value to something other than the market value, they still then, when they calculate the tax, they are required by the Constitution to choose the lesser of market value or the maximum assessed value under Measure 50. So that adjusted faux market value would not even be a part of the consideration in determining how much their taxes would be, which I don't think would get you exactly what you're looking for when it comes to creating an incentive or a disincentive in this process. So I can go into a great amount of detail about how that works. I have charts, and I assume you might not want me to go there.
Maybe an accurate assumption. Thank you, Mr. Phillips. Questions for this panel? Representative Vega Peterson.
Thank you, Chair. Nice to see you in the afternoon. So I think the intention of this, you know, part is to try to incentive. Have we tried anything else in any other situations like this where we've looked at the property value and addressed this in a different way?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vega Pearson, also nice to see you in the afternoon. The one latitude that I think the constitutional limitations provides is that the legislature can implement any kind of manipulation of those values that calculate tax that decreases the liability. So there are roughly 123 property tax exemption programs that either create a special assessment or an exemption or a partial exemption. And in all those cases, we're using something other than a market value. And so there are means by which you could impose a specially assessed value, which is also acknowledged in the Constitution as a possible venue. But it's always going to get you something less than rather than more than. So it would make it easier for you to incent behavior rather than to create a disincentive by increasing someone's taxes. Does that answer your question?
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you.
Okay.
And for the record, committee, we often see Mr. Phillips in front of the Revenue Committee at 8 a.m. So, Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Paul, how long has it been since we had money in the Brownfields Redevelopment Fund?
Chair Bailey, Representative Vence. I believe the fund was capitalized in 2000 at approximately $9 million. We've given out approximately $12 million, obviously through the revolving loan process. I am not aware of any recent infusions of monies into the fund of late. So I would have to get back with you as to the current balance. I want to say it's in approximately the 700,000 range with a couple of projects pending. But hopefully that answers your question in terms of what it was capitalized at and even some additional information on top of it.
Right. Follow up. Right. So the suggestion here is that we put $10 million into this fund and then that be loaned or there be grants issued. Were we loaning the money out previously, or what happened to the money, the $9, $12 million? Where did it go, and what good came from it?
Representative Bailey, or Chair Bailey, Representative Vence. Yeah, I don't necessarily have the specifics on that, and I'd have to get back with you as to kind of what the breakdown was of those monies. And I think, frankly, there have been some sizable projects that we've taken on of late that have depleted some of the resources at our disposal.
The situations generally are very expensive in determining what the underground situation is, and lots of discussion about who's responsible for what, and much of these expenses are caught up in litigation and then just in engineering studies trying to decide who it is that's really responsible, and not enough generally is spent on the actual cleanup. The question would be, if one engages on this, you almost have to do a whole bunch of studies first to find out the scope of nature of the problem, and then only then does one have an understanding of how much it's really going to cost. And then, and only then, would one know if you could actually loan money and take security back for it, because you certainly wouldn't want to take the property back as security. So when I look at these situations, I want them to work. But having been involved in a number of gasoline cleanup situations with your department, and you guys do great work, it's the problem underground that is so challenging. So I'm just wondering, when it comes to $10 million, how much do you think we could really do with it? It's looking back, it would be nice to be able to see what we've done in the past, how much that $13 million bought us, whether we're fooling ourselves and thinking this is going to do that much. And I'm all for trying to help, because I understand the challenge that we heard about, but I sure want to know kind of the scope and value of what we're engaging upon.
Chair Bailey, Representative Vence, I appreciate that, the comment, and we can certainly provide some forecast to the committee in terms of what we think the expectation would be in terms of what that $10 million may ultimately yield. For the record, I want to be clear, the department does not have a position on this bill. It is not in the governor's budget, but we're really here to provide information to the committee on this.
Thank you, and I do think that information would be helpful if they could provide it. Further questions of this panel? Representative Whitsitt.
Following up on Representative Vence's, what is the average cost to reclaim a gas station site, for example? You probably have some average.
Chair Bailey, Representative Whitsitt, I don't have an answer for that. I will certainly try to get you one. I was going to add on to Representative Vence's question that if you're, in our experience, if you're talking smaller sites, which gas stations can be, Representative Vince's point is well taken. One never knows how the contamination actually feeds underground, and that is where an enormous amount of the money is spent. But for assessment purposes only, which is to try to define the level of contamination, a working figure that we have used is $50,000 to $70,000. Now, I need to understand, Representative, that ties specifically back to gas stations as opposed to just smaller projects. But as a working figure, $50,000 to $70,000 for smaller projects can tell you just simply the level of contamination. That does not take you through the process of actually doing the cleanup, which can be much more expensive. But it gives you an initial scope of the potential risk, the contamination risk.
Follow-up. I had a big question, which I'm sure you can't answer, but it was, what would you anticipate anticipate would be the total cost of remediation for everything on there, and what does this $10 million do in the great scheme of things?
How many stars do we get?
Yeah. And I think I heard the answer over right there, but
Well, we'll get we'll get at least a understanding, I think, of what that $10 million might provide.
Well, if I may, Chair Bailey, Representative Whitson, so we have a separate account called the Orphan Site account, and that's for those situations where there's no responsible party. They're not either able to pay or willing to pay, or we can't find a responsible party. We have calculated that to do the work for just that account for the next 10 years could be $50 to $60 million. That's only for that count, and that's, again, back to Representative Vince's point, you never know what's actually taking place underground. So that's a really, an estimate that should be taken with a considerable grain of salt. And that's, again, just a limited subset. And one thing I should add about the orphan site accounts, those are the sites that DEQ, again, there's no responsible party, and we deem them the highest priority because they're either a direct threat to drinking water or some other environmental risk. So that's that upper slice of you know, contaminated properties out there. This list would be much, much larger.
Seeing no further questions, thank you all very much for your testimony. Call up David Ashton, I believe, and Tim Kirsch, and Miranda Bateshell. I apologize for any wrong names I'm getting wrong.
I think so. I think it's just that. Do they, in addition to getting their property clean, do they get
whoever would like to begin?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Ashton. I'm Assistant General Counsel with the Port of Portland. I have 22 years of experience in dealing with environmental and natural resource issues, specifically dealing with contamination issues, both locally and around the country. The port has substantial experience with dealing with the redevelopment of contaminated properties and deals with a lot of contamination on waterfront properties. The port has actively participated in a number of studies within the city of Portland and regionally about the difference between the challenges of developing brownfield sites versus greenfield sites, including a study of the relative cost comparison between developing brownfields and greenfields. For several years, I participated in a project as a port representative called the Portland Harbor Redevelopment Initiative, which was dubbed Harbor Ready, which is a multi-stakeholder public participation process involving local, regional, state governments and various private parties, including the Portland Business Alliance, the Columbia Corridor Association, and others. The Harbor Ready project sought to find additional ways to facilitate brownfields redevelopment, whether in the form of interagency cooperation, potential economic incentives, regulatory streamlining, and enhancement of the protections available for innocent parties acquiring contaminated property. The studies that we've been involved in all basically concluded that financial incentives were essential to cover the financially upside down contaminated brownfield sites to convert them into cleaned up sites and get them ready for redevelopment. It's especially true for sites that are brownfield industrial redevelopment, where those sites have a lower market value and typically higher costs associated with them than converting those sites into residential, retail, or commercial sites. Unfunded, many of these brownfield sites continue to cause contamination, contribute to contamination to the surrounding properties in the area. Redevelopment of these sites is very daunting in terms of having to deal with the contamination issues before you can get to construction on a redevelopment project and get to a profitable ultimate product. The studies identified that the state brownfields grants and loans are invaluable in helping level the playing field between the brownfields and the greenfield sites. And in addition, the studies that we did noted that the loan and grant programs could be expanded from covering such things as dealing with the removal of buildings in order to get to the contamination underneath to remove it, to also cover the costs of dealing with buildings which themselves contain contamination, like asbestos or toxic paints or PCB-containing insulation. So to assist with the cost of removal, the demolition of the buildings themselves. The Harbor Redevelopment Initiative Project also looked at a potentially perverse incentive that's being created by the property tax abatement program, where the value of property can be reduced by the cost of cleaning it up. The potential unintended consequence of that is that there's no correlative incentive to encourage the party to actually get the site cleaned up and back into productive use, back on the tax rolls, raising property taxes associated with the property. And so that the idea of coming up with some incentive to try to address that disincentive to clean up is something that's worth further review. The basic bottom line and why the port urges you to support House Bill 3030 is that we believe that the grant and loan program with the additional incentives can facilitate the redevelopment of waterfront properties, create useful additional tools for the redevelopment of brownfields. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to answer any questions when ready.
Thank you very much. Please.
Chair Bailey, representatives, thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House Bill 3030. My name is Miranda Bateshell, and I am the program manager for Metro's Brownfields Recycling Program, Metro being the regional government of the Portland metro area. We have a big stake in brownfield redevelopment to protect the health of our citizens, to protect our environment, to use our land most efficiently, and to create vibrant communities throughout the region and create places for jobs and housing for our citizens. For the last 6 years, we have had EPA money that we have used to work with property owners and communities to restore properties that have historic contamination issues. We have seen some of those go on to have cleanup and are in the works for redevelopment, and some of those have not, because there are a number of hurdles associated with these historic releases that burden today's businesses and residents, and keeping those sites from becoming productive and posing health risks to our communities. So we recently collaborated with a number of private and public stakeholders to conduct a regional brownfield scoping project. I've included the executive summary of that report in with my testimony. And you can find our full report online, but we can provide that to you as well if you'd like it. I just want to highlight a few key findings which really show why this is such an important issue to all the communities in the Portland metro area. There are up to 2,300 properties across all the jurisdictions. This is in our small towns, historic downtown centers, as well as in Portland or in the harbor. But it even stretches out to some of our areas that haven't even been urbanized yet in our urban reserves. There are half of all the brownfields that we highlighted are within 1,000 feet of our sensitive environmental areas. And there are a disproportionate number of brownfields in underserved communities than in non-underserved communities. We found that the vast majority of sites, approximately 1,800, are in our centers and our corridors or in major transportation routes. But the majority of our acreage is actually in our industrial areas and at the edges of our region. I did want to highlight, since the question came up earlier, and this is something that we looked at in our report, the average costs of brownfield redevelopment. At the low end, we highlighted approximately $60,000 per acre, but at the high end, almost $700,000 per acre. So you can see the vast discrepancy based on the size of the site, as well as the type of contamination that might be there. And we looked at both the worst case and best case in our scoping project. These sites, despite the number and because of the number represent a huge opportunity at law that's lost to us. At build out, they could provide over 65,000 jobs and almost 140,000 dwelling units, resulting in millions of dollars in annual property and personal income tax. But most of these sites cannot redevelop on their own. And that is why Metro supports developing a range of policy tools to address the range of challenges that these brownfield sites experience. Almost half of the brownfields in the region, what we found was almost half of them are close to the financial tipping point. What that means is that as policymakers, we can implement programs and incentives that move almost half of our brownfield sites from infeasible to feasible. And so we can have a big impact on spurring brownfield redevelopment and increasing tax revenues and then creating better and healthier communities throughout the state. We studied a number of policy tools in the report. We did a return on investment analysis that showed multiple tools are necessary. Not one tool will impact all the sites because the problems are so varying. But today, this bill addresses two of the policy tools that we studied in our report, and that is why we support this bill. First, it takes an important step and changes our current property assessment structure. I understand that's still being discussed, and as David mentioned, we want to make sure that something is done because right now property owners are incentivized to do nothing. They're getting a tax abatement to do nothing. And instead, we want to be able to try to support some type of incentive to restore the environment and bring those sites into productive reuse. We also looked at, the second part of this bill looks at a $10 million grant fund. We looked at a grant fund in our policy analysis, and we showed that approximately $10 million could provide 500 to 1,000 jobs and 1 to 2,000 dwelling units. Now, obviously, these numbers will shift depending on the criteria that's established, whether you want to focus more on industrial lands or lands that might produce more housing units, and also where the money is spent throughout the state. But even at the low end, what that's showing us is how big of a difference we could create for those communities and the people that live there. I want to highlight the current Business Oregon loan and grant program, which is funded at the same level. In the last 2 years, it has helped 30 brownfield sites throughout the state. And so at Metro, in the work that we do, it's clear that we need to do something to help restore these sites in our local communities and redevelop brownfields and to address the challenges that are faced by populations in our region. We also see that there's a demand for policy changes and financial assistance. The programs that we currently have are being taken advantage of fully. And we want to see the benefits. We see that the potential benefits could be extensive, and we think it's important to take those actions. So thank you again, Chair Bailey, and members of the committee. We would like to continue to work moving forward with you on these policy tools as well as others.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sir.
Chairman Bailey and committee, thank you very much for this opportunity. My name is Tim Kirsch. I'm mayor of Mill City, 30 miles east of here on Highway 22. I've submitted some testimony before you, but I want to go off of that and give you my story a little bit. Mill City received a $71,000 grant from the Brownfield Redevelopment Fund, and it's something that was... It would have created a huge hardship to the community of Mill City if we would have had to clean up a certain site on our own. Mill City was subject to a arson fire, burned down our city hall a couple of years ago. In starting to rebuild our city hall, we needed to move to a different location due to code upgrades and code changes. We were no longer able to rebuild where we were at. So the new site we moved to, wonderful spot right along the main street. However, we didn't know that 80 years ago, that site was where they repair shop for the local train engine was housed, as well as the refueling station. So about 3 feet into the ground, there was a layer of bunker C oil, which is the fuel used to for the trains at that time. At that time. So as soon as it was unearthed, all development stopped, and we called in some special advisors and DEQ and assessed the situation, and that's where we were told about the Brownfield funds. it was kind of expedited because we had boots on the ground there to do our project, and we didn't. This was definitely unexpected. So the site review, the cleanup, the excavation, all costs for us was actually fairly low, just a little over $80,000. Most of it covered with the grant of $71,000, and now we have a clean bill of health from the DEQ. The site is also right along the North Santa Ana River, drinking water for the city of Salem, as well as many other communities downstream. Without the money in that fund, I want to say that the site would probably have a large pile of dirt off to one side right now, covered with black plastic to keep it from leaching any further. But the funds definitely was what made it for us able to happen. So with that, I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify and once again show my support for the recapitalization of the fund.
Mr. Mayor, thank you for making the trip and for your testimony. It's a great story, great success story, and to both of you for the explanation of how this kind of program can be useful across many jurisdictions and in many areas. Questions for this panel? Representative Whitsitt?
I don't know who might be able to answer this, but I was wondering if you have any sense of how many of these contaminated properties statewide have reverted to the counties for lack of property tax payments. If how many are sitting out there that people just walked away from?
We may be able to find that from the agency representatives and get that information
great
to you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question, I think, for the port is this. Do you think our money would be best spent if we used it just to respond to someone who wanted to know how big the problem was, so that we would pay, let's say, for the testing and then illustrate to the market how much problem we had, and didn't try to engage in the actual cleanup? Because if the goal is to maximize these dollars, and perhaps the best way to do it is to show the market which ones are easily cleaned up and which ones not.
Chair Bailey and Representative Benz, that could well be an approach that is considered. I think it's consistent with the way the program is run currently. By Business Oregon, that they can take those kind of considerations into account in deciding what grants or loans to award. I think, however, you've heard earlier that some sites don't take a very significant amount of money to get them completely cleaned up, and so the difference between covering the cost of the investigation versus covering the cost of the investigation and the cleanup altogether may not be that significant. So I think that the program would need to be sufficiently flexible to, in the right circumstances, address both investigation and cleanup. But that is certainly one way to stretch limited funds across a larger number of sites.
Thank you.
Makes sense. Seeing no further questions, thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. I'd like to call up Jen Bildersee, Robert Brott, and Craig Ward, please. Please.
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Jen Bildersee. I'm the program coordinator for the City of Portland Brownfield Program. We're a city program that provides support to assess, clean up, and revitalize brownfield properties throughout the City of Portland. I'm here to express Portland's support for this policy, which provides important tools for assessing and cleaning up contaminated sites. As has been spoken to by many of those testifying so far, these are properties throughout the state. And I'm going to speak today about the sites that I'm familiar with in Portland and some of the studies we've done recently. But these really are large industrial sites and also small commercial sites, old gas stations, old dry cleaners that are on main streets and commercial corridors in every city and town. A study that the city completed just 3 months ago found 910 acres of brownfield in Portland alone, There's a summary of that study that was presented to you with written testimony. The research found that it would cost $214 million to clean all of these sites up. But the good news that the study came to conclude was that this would return $240 million each year just in tax revenue if these brownfield sites were fully redeveloped. And it would also create 31,000 new jobs, again, on these 910 acres of Portland's brownfields. Again, looking at these numbers, I just want to speak to, since it's come up earlier, when you're looking at a $214 million figure just for Portland, then what does $10 million mean? On some of these sites, a very small amount of support can really go a long way. Sometimes it really is just the perception of contamination that's standing in the way of something happening on a property. And so several tens of thousands of dollars that can provide a site assessment to delineate the contamination, understand what the barriers are, can make the difference between a site redeveloping and a site sitting vacant. I also want to speak to the earlier concern about is the strategic investment really assessment? And then maybe leaving cleanup for later. It's very useful to have cleanup funds available. When there are assessment dollars and not cleanup dollars available, that is sometimes a disincentive for somebody to take on assessment because they're afraid to understand the scope of the problem and then not have access to any resources that would allow them to actually address it. So having the flexibility in funding is something that's really been valuable on Portland sites. On some sites, particularly on industrial ones, the cost of cleanup of the site exceeds the value of the property when it's cleaned. And that's why these policy tools are so important. Without them, many sites remain vacant indefinitely. The proven successful tools that are supported in this bill, for example, Oregon Business Development Department's Brownfield Redevelopment Fund, have been extremely useful on properties in Portland. This is a resource that's been around for 13 years. It's supported projects in 24 of Oregon's 36 counties, and I'm just going to speak quickly to two significant ones in Portland. One is the Acme Scenic and Display in Northeast Portland. This is a large industrial site that was a former pesticide manufacturing facility, which is pretty much exactly what you're picturing. And now, with some assistance from OBDD, it is a specialty construction business. Cleaning up the site, having the site available, allowed a local business to expand and to hire new employees. Another site that I had the privilege to work on is kind of demonstrates the breadth of sites. It was the Tabor Commons site in Southeast Portland. It's this very small commercial site. It was an old gas station. It's directly across the street from an elementary school. This is a site that, like many old contaminated sites, started to fall into disrepair and became a place where drug trafficking was occurring. It was seized by the U.S. Marshals and was turned over to the local community coalition. And with support from OBDD, the community and the Portland Brownfield Program, the community coalition was able to assess the site, find out what the contamination was, remove several tanks and contaminated soil. Now this is a real community resource, a meeting space, a coffee house. It really just speaks to the opportunity of these sites that Representative Frederick talks about, something that's a neighborhood blight with no future becomes a real opportunity. And that's what these policies are able to enable. Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
I'm just curious where that Tabor Commons location is.
57th and Division, Southeast 57th and Division, across from Atkinson Elementary.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, I've been to a number of meetings there. I had no idea that was a former brownfield site.
Indeed, there were.
It's a great space.
Three very large tanks that were removed from underground.
Thank you. Mr. Groff.
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Robert Grodd, Executive Director of the Northwest Environmental Business Council. And I'd like to speak in favor of HB 3030 and the recapitalization of the Brownfields Redevelopment Fund. And I just want to make some contextual comments. As a trade association, NEBC represents dozens of service and technology companies working in brownfields in Oregon. And we also manage the Oregon Brownfields listserv that has over 1,300 subscribers, including a large number who work for local governments trying to figure out how to revitalize their communities. And so the message I want to leave you with today is that reusing brownfields is not just jobs and net economic impacts, but redeveloping brownfields is also a matter of redeveloping communities. Brownfields, as you heard, exist in every corner of the state. Every community has gas stations, old dry cleaners, repair shops, mills and factories, leaving holes in the middle of the community that cannot be fully reused without cleaning up that contamination. And Oregon is a leader in the nation in managing urban growth. And central to this strategy is creating vibrant, vital downtown cores with their compact development. And as you know, compact development is also the key to efficient transportation. But as, of course, you've heard, cleaning up contamination can be expensive. It also can be very expensive to figure out how much cleanup is needed and how much it will cost. And so unless we're dealing with a handful of high-value infill properties, local governments and property owners need the help, and that's where the Brownfields Redevelopment Fund comes in. The BRF is a great example of a leveraging tool where a modest amount of government money can lead to a vastly greater amount of private investment and subsequent economic development. And now, finally, as Oregon's just emerging from the recession and development activity is picking back on, it's precisely the time to give natural market forces a boost so that we can help getting more redevelopment projects over the starting line. So thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you very much. Mr. Ward.
Good afternoon, Chair Bailey, members of the committee. My name is Craig Ward. I'm city manager for the city of Troutdale. It's a community of 16,000 located at the confluence of the Sandy and Columbia Rivers on the western most boundary of the Columbia Gorge National Scenic Area. I suspect most of you know it. You may know of an outlet mall that's located there. Yeah, I'm here really to speak to the properties that are immediately between the outlet mall and the Sandy River, which the outlet mall and these two other properties constitute our urban renewal area. It's an area that's actually larger than most of our downtown. Aside from the outlet mall, which really isn't part of the brownfield, what we have is a site, 12 acres that were a former wastewater treatment plant site for the city, and 8 acres that are owned by a private party. That site, in many respects, the reason that Troutdale exists, because they decided they would build a slaughterhouse there many years ago, adjacent to both the river and the railroad. And I don't want to mischaracterize what happened there, but I think it's fairly typical that in a whole range of activities, and you've heard of some of those today, the tendency was when you had leftovers, you just sort of dumped them out back. And over time, those become covered and the like. And a private property owner purchased that property and then discovered that, in fact, they had a brownfield. The money that we were able to get, the grant money, about $65,000 from Business Oregon, was absolutely critical to helping that property owner understand the scope of the problem and actually come to the conclusion that it was fixable, that it wasn't so huge. And in fact, the more study we've done on it, the smaller the scope of the problem appears to be. And consequently, while we did an urban renewal plan that defined what the city hoped to have on that property, on the entire urban renewal, the property owner eventually then decided that they were going to come to grips with the development opportunity they have. I mean, this is waterfront on the Sandy River. It's the only urban designation of property on the Sandy River. And so they came up with a redevelopment plan. We're actively engaged with them in marketing the property, and the money we received from both Business Oregon and DEQ to help characterize the scope of the problem has gone a long way towards making that property marketable and helping the business owner engage in the opportunity that property had, not just the liability that they had for it. Mm-hmm. So I am here to speak in favor of the bill, in particular those elements that that would recapitalize the fund, but also the provision in there to allow the demolition of structures that contain hazardous substances is very important to us as well, because that too is a large burden on both the property owner and ourselves, and it would be a helpful component. So thank you. I'll be happy to answer any questions. Appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Questions for this panel?
I would simply say it. You all touched on it in your testimony to some degree, but Ms. Bildersley, I heard it in yours very clearly about the spark that can catalyze greater economic development in a community, not just for jobs, but also for increased revenue from these properties over time, and frankly, the larger community aspect and reduction of blight that I think is sometimes something that we don't calculate into the monetary value of what we're investing in these properties. So I appreciate that testimony. It seems like there's a lot of potential here. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. I'd like to call up, I'm sorry, I'm having a hard time with the name here. I think it's Amy Siberion. Okay. And Doug McCourt. And I think that's it.
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity. My name is Amy Siberion. And I am here to testify in support of the House Bill 3030 with my legal advisor suggestion. I'm just going to support the part that is funding the administrative, the redevelopment fund to administrate by Oregon Business Development. I just want to share a little bit of my story and the sparks that brownfields bring to the communities. I'm a registered professional engineer with the state of Oregon, and been involved with remediation and the consulting engineering of environmental problems for over 20 years. I have my forte is in brownfields development, and through years of my experience, I came to experience and see that the ache and pain of the property owners, especially the small property owners, that they had this huge problem in their properties and they didn't know how to deal with it, and no resources to help them. 7 years ago, knowing the problem, being an entrepreneur, and understanding the risks, and also seeing the opportunities with this kind of properties, I took over contaminated properties. Actually, it was an orphan site, DEQ orphan site. It was an old gas station with abandoned for years. I would pass by that property every day to go to work, and I know what's going on with it. So I took over that property, purchased it, and tried to develop a model, a business model, that what can be done with a small property like that. Not only cleaning it up, but take it to the next level of developing a business. So the last 7 years, it has been, I can write a book. I have 2 or 3 minutes to talk about it, but I just want to give you the highlights. The first step to deal with this property is to manage the risk, manage the environmental liability. That seems the main fear of anybody who deals with these properties. To manage this liabilities is to understand what's on the site. I was probably one of the first people who applied for the revolving loan with the Oregon Business Development in 2005, and I received a loan. And with that money, that was a seed money, we basically removed the tanks from the property, we clean up the source, not totally clean up the site, but we address the problem, and we manage the liability in a way that I could go to a bank and ask for a loan, and they understand that they're not going to have any risk with this site when it's developed. So we were able, that loan enabled us to secure the loan to not only develop the site, but it takes it or clean up the site and do the, through the construction and take it to a business. That Nick's Auto Body old gas station today is Alba Roasteria. It's a community gathering place. It's a coffee house, basically. With what we got from or started with the Oregon Business Development, we not only protected human health and managed environmental liability for that site, but we also created jobs. We enhanced economic growth for that community, increased property value in that area to a sense that I couldn't buy another piece of property to support my original investment. And it became a community gathering place, from an eyesore to a favorite coffee house, and especially the part that is really close and dear to my heart is the fact that a lot of young adults spend a lot of their time in that space. Being a mother, that by itself is the only reward that I expected from the site. The project, actually over the last 7 years, it became the voice of Beaverton community. It changed a great deal of City of Beaverton's vision that what they want to do with their downtown. Currently, I'm involved with the research with Oregon State University that looking into barriers of why the sites are not being developed. And it seems the main barrier, and our hope is, our goal is, to find a way in what ways we can expedite and in what ways we can move these properties, not only just after the cleanup, but to the next level. The main barrier that came out is the fear of liability. Accessible money like the one that this bill would support would provide enough to manage the liability. Again, I keep saying manage the liability means what is it there and how much of it that needs to be corrected and what's the dollar value attached to it, how long it takes. The fact is you don't need to start a business on this kind of properties fully cleaning them up. You can start it when you understand what's in there. You can start a business and concurrently do both, run the operation, and actually the operation would pay for additional cleanup in the future. As part of that research that I'm doing, I did a lot of literature search on the EPA sites, and one of the newest publication that was released by EPA had some fact that I thought it's interesting for you guys to know. For every dollar of brownfields money is spent, and these are based on the brownfields loan and grant, based on the 2002 brownfields law, basically funding. And the study was revealed in 2013, just February 2013. So it seems that for every dollar of brownfields money that the EPA has spent, there is a leverage of $17.78. For every $100,000 that is spent, there is a leverage of 7.5 jobs. The advantage of the original cleanup money with the project that I was involved, it didn't stop at the managing environmental liability. It went further, economic growth, job creation, tax benefits to local and federal government. It can even be based of creating a business like Ava Roasteria. It's right now Ava Roasteria is a growing company with 3 successful operations. We have over 40 employees. We're in the process of developing 3 more stores by 2015. None of this would have been happening without original cleanup funding from the Oregon Business Development Department. So this is my story. It's just, those sparks from brownfields, that what can be done with those kind of properties. It is happening, it is possible, and this kind of funding, it provides that seed money to let this development happen.
Thank you for your work and for sharing your story. And I will comment, your state representative, Tobias Reed, first introduced me to Ava Roasteria several years ago. I've been back probably 9 or 10 times since. The turkey cranberry sandwich with the chocolate macaroon is a great, it's a delightful combo. My only complaint is that there's so many people there. It's so popular. Sometimes it's hard to, get a table. So,
Chair Bill, thank you very much for your comment. I'm sure the reason we are in the business is because you're supporting.
Sir.
Representative Bailey, Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Doug McCord. I'm a partner with the Oregon law firm Vader Wynn, the firm's Portland office. And as Amy mentioned, I am. She is one of our clients, as well as the City of Troutdale. And the reason I'm here is not because I'm here as their lawyer, but because we've worked through the trenches from the beginning on these projects, and they are the real risk takers, both from the public entity, from Craig that you heard from a minute ago, as well as Amy on the private sector side. And, I just help them navigate some of the regulations and some of the funding, but those two elements are pretty critical. And I've got, I still have some hair left, but it's pretty much all gray, which is the point of the fact that I've been around this field for most of the last 25 years. And I wanted to use some of that experience to just outline a little bit of the history of how you got here, because I think it's helpful in a couple of respects moving forward from this point, both in terms of supporting this bill and thinking about the funding mechanisms. But just to be clear, I'm testifying in support of those aspects of House Bill 3030 that serve to recapitalize the Brownfields Redevelopment Fund administered by Business Oregon. For both the Troutdale site and Ava Rosteria, we're going to put together some additional materials that I think will go to some of Representative Bence's questions about, you know, how do you see the value come out of a $10 million fund? How much money do you get out of one of these grants, or in the case of a private sector loan? And how does that translate into it? The number of jobs, the number of tax revenues that you generate over a period of time? And I think we'll provide, you'll see that level of detail in the materials we'll follow up with. As I mentioned, from over 25 years working to clean up and redevelop contaminated sites in Oregon, across the U.S. and actually overseas, I can tell you that Oregon has one of the best programs in the nation for three reasons that I can identify, and of course the people have a lot to do with it, but in part it's because of the existence of both grant and loan programs to fund both private sector and public sector activities, like the redevelopment fund that's in House Bill 3030, but it's also because of the allocation of brownfield funding between state agencies and the collaboration between those agencies in implementing economic development programs on the one hand and cleanup programs on the other. One of the things that we've looked at over the last couple decades in these programs is that states that put all the eggs in one basket tend not to be the most successful. They tend to create a lot of conflicts, especially for agencies like the Department of Environmental Quality, who have a statutory mandate to protect human health and the environment. And if the money starts moving to certain projects, then there's questions raised about, you know, whether that's the right or the wrong thing to do. So we did the right thing. And the way we got to this was back in 1995, House Bill 3352 created a task force. It radically changed Oregon's cleanup law, but among other things, it created what was then called the Oregon Brownfields Funding Task Force. That task force was charged by the Legislative Assembly to come back in 2 years with recommendations on a suite of funding programs. It did that. It recommended the programs, including the definition of brownfields that you heard from Mr. Grove. We created that. I was a member of that task force, and we created that definition, as well as three programs that exist in our recommendation in 1997 from House Bill 3724. Those recommendations were adopted. Ultimately, those programs were put in place in 99 and funded in 2001. And what's the relevance of that? Part of it is that there's a record of this House having a lot of really in-depth conversation about what they should fund, how much they should fund, answering and asking a lot of the questions that you asked. And one thing I would have to say, and Amy and I were looking at each other when we were hearing various figures thrown around, is that it's probably not as productive an exercise to try to pin down the average cost of a cleanup or the average cost of an investigation, but to look at the process and how different properties in different settings go through different processes and how much they cost. You can spend millions of dollars on 1 acre, or you can get through a gas station site with $20,000. I mean, it's that variable, okay? One of the reasons why I bring up the structure of where this body has been from creating the Brownfields Redevelopment Fund and funding it in 2001 is that the recommendations to the 97 Oregon Assembly were to create programs that help the public and private sectors bring jobs and revenues back to Oregon communities. The considerations of that task force are as critical and relevant today as they were in 97, and those specifically included understanding and reducing potential threats to public health and the environment, successfully managing land use densities and urban growth pressures, increasing tax revenues, and promoting economic development. In just a decade, the Business Oregon Brownfield programs have provided the desperately needed seed money to investigate and help redevelop brownfields throughout the state in both rural and urban communities, as you've heard of earlier today. We've accomplished a lot, but as the map shows, we've got a long way to go. And continuing the Business Oregon Brownfield funding programs at the existing funding rate is essential to bring these sites back to the tax rolls. As the committee considers House Bill 3030 and the mechanisms to continue funding programs at Business Oregon, I'd just like to leave you with a couple of observations about the sites that you're hearing from Ava Rosteria, Troutdale, and some of the other ones.
most public and private entities that take the risk and tackle these sites had nothing to do with creating the contamination, but the law, both federal and state law, makes them 100% jointly and severally liable. And so that creates a great amount of risk when most people who want to invest in these sites, especially in economies like this, are saying, look, just bring me something plain vanilla, low-hanging fruit, something easy. I don't have the extra cash to spend on all the transactional difficulty, all of the extra programs and going hunting for grants and all of that. But the next stage is probably the most critical one, and we've heard this come up in a few people's testimony, but I'll underscore it here, and that is that in many sites, and this is statistically proven both nationwide and in Oregon, you don't have to go too far beyond the site investigation and the risk assessment stage in order to create the kind of economic engine that Amy's created with Ava Roasteria. That doesn't mean you stop and you don't address the public health concerns, but that means you follow the structure, the risk-based cleanup structure that we established in 95 through House Bill 3352, and most of the money gets you to a point where you can actually start building, hire people, create jobs, and bring in tax revenues. You don't have to worry about getting to that end point, partly because the law keeps some of those original parties, if they can be found, on the hook, and partly because you can continue to generate income to start paying for some of those bills. So what that does is it's really critical to continue to have a fund for site assessment and site investigation. Once that nature and extent of the contamination is known, you can allocate the risk between the parties, both current and maybe not present. You can deal with the timelines and the development plans that need to go in to actually get sticks on the ground, and you can obtain financing. And that is what's driving most of the brownfield redevelopment today.
I want to make sure we leave a couple of minutes for questions.
You bet. You bet. So we'll be providing details on these programs, anything, or on the projects you heard, and anything else we can do, to whether historical or current. One note of caution that I would leave you with, as you explore mechanisms to alter the tax status of brownfield sites, keep in mind that there are numerous small businesses across the state who can and do benefit from the existing tax structure. And so it is, I guess I would urge caution to tinker with that. And I would do so with a mind toward keeping whatever standard you come up with the most flexible and the easiest to both determine how you get to clean and when you get to clean, so that it gives people who actually have spent the money and have businesses the ability to get a tax break because they deserve it. We'll leave time for questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Representative Whitsitt.
Do you think it would make any sense to have a statute regarding insurance liability or relief or a limit at a certain point in the assessment process that you go through to determine how contaminated is this, and you determine that, and then if we had something that limits the liability after that point, would you attract more people to redevelop these, perhaps?
Representative Whitsitt, let me make sure I'm completely understanding your question. Are you asking whether it would be possibly a good idea to tack on an insurance requirement?
No, I'm asking if it would be better to have the state release the new owner at a certain point after you've reached a certain point of assessment, so that they can go forward and not be afraid of being sued.
Yes.
I'm just trying to think of a way to encourage more development and more investment.
Well, the state actually has that program, and that again was one of the things introduced in House Bill 3352 in 95. It's called the Prospective Purchaser Program. We've got, what is 95? Well, a little over 18 years of track record under our belt now. We were doing them actually before then, but we were doing them on an ad hoc basis. But what it does is it provides the prospective purchaser, before they come into it, with both a release of liability from the state as well as contribution protection from third parties in exchange for some quid pro quo. The statutory definition is substantial public benefit, but it is proven to be probably one of the most effective ways to encourage people to get into that market and then provide the kind of liability relief. And what it also does is it gives the agency, and for that matter the whole world, the information necessary to look backwards and say, well, who did really create this mess? And can we actually go get them? It's one of the best tools. And honestly, we didn't think it up. The 102nd Congress did, and back then, people were fighting. It was this odd bipartisan stuff, you know. And we just
got
tired.
We're keeping the discussion germane to this bill, though.
Yeah. So what happened is we took it and we did that program. So yeah,
thanks.
It's there.
Great. Thank you. Further questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 3030? Seeing none, colleagues, you'll see this up. I believe we have it scheduled for a work session Thursday, so we'll have some additional discussion on this bill. With that, close public hearing on House Bill 3030. Committee, would stand at ease just a moment, please. Okay, committee will resume, and we're going to hold over House Bill 2801. We do not have the paperwork for that. Thank you for your patience, committee. And with that, committee is adjourned.